Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, has had a dream, and it's left him frightened and worried. He's the most powerful man in the world. He's turned Babylon into an amazingly beautiful, awesome city. He's built up a vast empire by defeating one country after another. People think of Nebuchadnezzar as almighty, infallible. They worship him as if he were God. He's the embodiment of human greatness. But this great king, this Superman, is coming to pieces. He's scared out of his wits by this vivid dream. Well, there's a group of men in Babylon whose job it is to advise the king. You could say that they're the top civil servants. And their special skill is that they're supposed to have supernatural powers. Some of them are magicians, some of them are astrologers. So the king calls for the most senior members of this group. And he tells them that they've got to explain what the dream means. But he's determined that they're not going to fob him off with some story that they've concocted. So he wants to test that they really do have some supernatural ability. So he refuses to tell them what he had actually dreamt. He simply says to them, first, you've got to tell me what I dreamt, and then I'll trust you to interpret the dream. And they're horrified. There's not a man on earth who can do what the king asks, they say. And the king is enraged. And in his fury, he orders that every single one of those advisors should be put to death. Well, there was one very junior member of the civil service. Far too junior to be in the group, the elite who were called before the king. His name was Daniel. He was Jewish. And Daniel knew the true God. Well, Daniel was going to be put to death with all the rest of the king's advisors. But when the police came to arrest him, he said, well, just take me to the king. I can interpret the dream. So Daniel was taken to the king. And he said to the king, just give me time, and I'll tell you what the dream was, and I'll interpret it. And then Daniel went away, and he gathered his believing friends together, and he urged them to pray that God would reveal the meaning of this dream to him. All the magicians, all the enchanters, all the top experts of Babylon couldn't solve this problem. But Daniel was sure that Yahweh, the God of heaven, the Lord, could show him the answer. And God did. So Daniel could go back to the king and say this. It's in verse 27. No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he's asked about. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in days to come. Your dream and the visions that pass through your mind as you lay on your bed are these. Daniel's going to tell the king what the dream was and what the dream meant. But first, he's got to tell the king just how he found out. He's got to take the opportunity to preach to the king the fact that there is a real God, a sovereign God, a God who's in control of everything. Notice the words that Daniel uses here in verse 28. He says, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. And there's a barb in those words once you put them in their context. There's a God in heaven, says Daniel. Remember, Babylon is the place where they tried to build a tower that would reach from earth to heaven. Babylon's the place where human beings said, we're capable of reaching heaven. We're capable of being gods ourselves. That's what Nebuchadnezzar claims for himself. He's the great head of the human race, of man. And he's going to lift mankind up to heaven. He's going to solve all the world's problems. Man, headed up by Nebuchadnezzar, is going to take the place of God. And Daniel says to him, there's a God in heaven. You may be very great, Nebuchadnezzar, but you are still here on earth. You're still crawling about on the face of this little planet. You know, you can build your great hanging gardens that seem to hang from the sky, but it's an illusion. You can't lift yourself beyond your own limitations, Nebuchadnezzar. You can't build a staircase to heaven. It's another world. You can't reach up to heaven, but there is a God in heaven who can reach down to you. He can put a dream into your mind. He can dictate what happens on earth. He can hide the truth or he can reveal the truth. No man on earth can ever reach up and challenge God because he's in heaven. But God in heaven can reach down and do anything he wants here on earth. That's what's built into Daniel's words. It's a direct rebuke to Nebuchadnezzar's grandiose humanist dreams. With all your greatness, Nebuchadnezzar, you're on earth. And God is in heaven. And then Daniel begins to relate the king's dream back to the king. He says, what you dreamed was this. You dreamed that you saw a gigantic statue of a man. Dazzling. Awesome. In a sense, that's what Nebuchadnezzar's been dreaming about all his life. Man himself becoming something majestic, awesome, something worthy to be worshipped. That's been the Babylonian vision ever since they built their first tower towards heaven. Remember, we talked about it in our first session on the book of Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar's got that picture in his mind of man filling the whole horizon, of man breaking through all his limitations, of man becoming all-powerful, all-knowing, man becoming divine. That's why Nebuchadnezzar's got this obsession with building a great empire. He's going to bring the whole human race together under his own control. And he believes that then, at last, man will achieve his potential. Man will be able to control his own destiny. At last, man will have reached his full dimensions. At last, the tower to heaven, if you like, will be completed. That's the great driving force behind everything Nebuchadnezzar does. So it's not surprising that this dream, this vision, should fill his mind even when he's asleep. Nebuchadnezzar is dreaming of man. Dazzling, awesome, godlike. But there's more to the dream than that. Daniel carries on to describe this giant statue. Look first at its head. And wow, it's dazzling. It's made of solid gold. But then move down from the head. Oh, well, it's not quite as splendid as I thought. But it's still very impressive. The chest, the arms are silver. But then move down a bit further. What about the torso and the thighs? They're bronze. Still quite grand, but nothing terribly special. And the legs? Well, they're just iron. And finally, you look down at the feet, and you realize that mixed in with the iron, there's clay. Clay that's been baked hard like brick. This whole gigantic statue is balanced on a brittle mixture of iron and clay. That isn't what Nebuchadnezzar wants to hear at all, is it? He wants to think of humanity, man, becoming more and more splendid, more and more dazzling. And he wants to think of himself uniting mankind into an empire that's totally secure, that'll last forever. But what his dream told him was that it's not like that. Yes, at first sight, just looking at the face, well, you think you've succeeded in making man glorious and godlike, golden. But as your eyes travel down, the picture soon stops being dazzling and awesome. And by the time you've reached the feet, you realize the whole thing is just so fragile. You know, when you look at that golden head, you might say, wow, here's a treasure that could last forever. But by the time you reach those clay feet, you say, wow, one blow on those brittle feet and the whole statue could topple. But there's more. Listen to the next part of the dream. Daniel says this to the king in verse 34. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, but not by human hands. It struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were broken to pieces at the same time and became like chaff on a threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace. Here's this great statue, this great picture of human ambition, human achievement, human empire, all built by man and for man. And then you see a rock, and it's cut out, but not by human hands at all. It's something that man never planned. It's something that man never set in motion. It's a rock cut out by God's own hands and set rolling by God's power. And the rock strikes the statue on its feet. And what happens? Does the statue slowly topple over and break into its various parts so that you've got the golden head still lying there intact and the silver chest still visible and the bronze torso and the iron legs all surviving? The whole statue just disintegrates into dust, like the dust that rises when you beat out the grain on the threshing floor. And the wind just comes and sweeps away even that dust, so that there's no trace left of that gigantic statue. It once looked so vast, so huge, so impressive, something worth worshipping. But now it's just vanished. It's gone as if it never existed. But meanwhile, Daniel says, the rock that struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth. As the dream comes to its end, there's only one thing left in the picture. Human ambition, human greatness, human dreams, they've all been smashed into smithereens. And only the rock that God cut out is left. And it fills the whole world. It becomes a gigantic mountain that bridges heaven and earth. No wonder Nebuchadnezzar was troubled by this dream. No wonder it left him shaken and terrified. What's it telling him? It's telling him that whatever he builds, however great his empire becomes, doesn't matter what wonderful things the human race accomplishes, doesn't matter how far he succeeds in uniting humanity and giving to it the capacity to achieve amazing things, Doesn't make any difference. In the end, nothing is going to be left out of everything he builds. And meanwhile, something completely different, something in which human beings have had no hand at all, is going to triumph. It's a hard thing for any man, isn't it, to realise that his own life's work has been for nothing. It's a hard thing to spend a lifetime working to become the best at something, to reach the top of a ladder, and then to realise that the world's moved on and that nobody's interested in your achievements, that the ladder's just been kicked away, that whatever you've spent your life building isn't actually worth anything any longer. Or it's a hard thing to realise that your achievements just aren't going to last. Imagine, let's say, a woman who becomes head teacher of a school, and she's determined to make it the best school in Manchester. She sees that as a worthwhile goal, so she devotes herself to that goal night and day. And bit by bit she sees the school improve, and she sees it moving up the exam rankings, and it becomes known for its sporting achievements and for its music, and she's interviewed in the Manchester Evening News as this super head who succeeded in turning around the school and making it the best school in the Northwest. And then almost before she knows it, she's due for retirement, and a new head is appointed. And within 12 months, he's managed to undo everything she spent her life doing. Discipline has collapsed. Academic standards have vanished. All the top teachers she brought in are demoralised and are applying for jobs elsewhere. And she says, what was it all for? I spent my life on this great project, and it's undone in a moment. It's undone in 6 months. But that's life here in this fallen world, isn't it? We've all been there at some point. We've thrown ourselves into some project, and we've convinced ourselves that it's really going to make a lasting difference. And we've forgotten that in the end, we can't guarantee that anything we build is going to last even our lifetime, let alone last forever. But what Nebuchadnezzar is seeing in his dream is that's not just true for human individuals. It's true for the whole human enterprise. Human beings have been dreaming, planning, working ever since the Tower of Babel, with the goal of building something of permanent value, dreaming that they can solve all mankind's problems, that they can build a society where man reaches his full potential. And suddenly, Nebuchadnezzar is being told that every human dream, every human society, every human achievement is going to vanish away without a trace. That was the king's dream. And Daniel tells the king, reminds the king of just what the king had dreamed. And then he begins to explain it in detail, point by point. Every part of the statue, he says, corresponds with one more human empire. One more attempt by a human king to build the perfect society, where man will be supreme. Start with the golden head, verse 37. You, O king, are the King of Kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands he's placed mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds of the air. Wherever they live, he's made you ruler over them all. You are that head of gold. Nebuchadnezzar really was an amazing man. He was one of the greatest men who ever lived. And he really did build an amazing empire. Science, art, architecture, they all flourished under Nebuchadnezzar's rule as they'd never done before. You could have visited Babylon in Nebuchadnezzar's day and you would have seen the most amazing buildings. You could have talked to astronomers who could accurately predict solar eclipses hundreds of years ahead. You could have visited zoos and found animals and birds brought from all over the world to Babylon and classified by the Babylonian scientists and studied. You could say that Nebuchadnezzar came closer than any man since Adam to being truly in control of the earth. And Daniel isn't afraid to say it. He says, "You're a truly great king. You're a king of kings, Nebuchadnezzar, because God has made you so." You may imagine that it's all just sprung from yourself, that somehow you've got some innate greatness, Nebuchadnezzar. It's not true. God has enabled you to build this wonderful empire. He's given you dominion and power and might and glory. He's even placed those beasts and birds under your control. You're the golden head. But this empire of yours will not last. You may think you're capable of building something that'll last forever, but you can't. Verse 39, after you, another kingdom will rise inferior to yours. A kingdom to match the silver chest and arms. It'll come, Nebuchadnezzar. Your empire will not last. And it did come. The Medes and the Persians under Cyrus the Great destroyed the Babylonian Empire and destroyed it overnight. And they became the great world power. And they shared all the same dreams. Cyrus was going to unite the whole human race. Under his control, he was going to build utopia. And again, Cyrus expected people to worship him as God. And again, he claimed that he could break through all human limitations. But the Persian Empire never reached the same splendor as Babylon. And again, it passed away. And then, says Daniel, a third kingdom, one of bronze, will roll over the whole earth. The Greeks, under Alexander the Great, smashed the Persian Empire. They became the superpower. And once again, Alexander set himself up as a god. And again, he promised that he would lift the human race up to heaven and that he would solve all the world's problems. But again, Alexander's empire disintegrated. And then, says Daniel, verse 40, finally, there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron. For iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all the others. The Roman Empire smashes Greece and then smashes everything else in its path, headed up by Augustus Caesar and then his successors, a series of emperors who claimed to be divine, who demanded worship, who said that they had come to bring salvation to the world. There's a word they used again and again. The emperor is the savior of the world. An empire which was itself thought of as divine, Dea Roma, the goddess Rome, divine Rome. Rome is the last of the four empires that Nebuchadnezzar sees in his vision. Rome has never really passed away. We're still living under the Roman Empire. All our European institutions derive from Rome. And we've exported them all over the world. All our literature is based on Roman models. All our European languages, including the global language English, have their roots in Latin. Roman law still underlies our legal system and the legal system of every global organization. We still write as the symbol of our currency for as long as we've got it, a curly L for the Latin libra. Till the 20th century, don't forget, the ruler of Germany was known as the Kaiser, and the ruler of Russia was known as the Tsar, and they're just versions of the name Caesar. They were all consciously the successors of the Caesars. Even now, governments all over the world have a Senate, which was the name of the legislative house in the Roman Empire. We call our leader the Prime Minister, and both those words are good Latin. Daniel told the king that the fourth empire would be a divided kingdom. Verse 41, just as you saw that the feet and toes were partly of baked clay and partly of iron, so this will be a divided kingdom. And that's what we can see today. The power of the Roman Empire has now been broken up into lots of individual little power bases. Washington, Moscow, Paris, London. But it is still one empire. And more than ever, it still enshrines the same man-centered, man-worshipping vision. What's the single most dominating idea in Western culture today? What's the driving force behind it all? We want to make God redundant. We want man to understand the universe without reference to God. We want to decide what's right and wrong without consulting God. We want to solve every human being without God's intervention. We want to build a perfect society and overcome disease and eliminate famine and crime and war and ultimately death itself. Man has to be self-sufficient. One great project stretching from Babylon to 21st century Britain. The project of making man into God. Of turning man into a self-sufficient creature worthy to be worshipped. But we've already seen that project is doomed. The great human project, the whole statue, is going to be smashed into smithereens. Listen again to what Daniel says in verse 44. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever. There is going to be a kingdom that will last forever. But it won't be the kingdom of Babylon or Persia or Greece or Rome. It will be a kingdom set up by the God of heaven. And it will smash all those kingdoms to smithereens. The rolling rock of God's kingdom will break up this whole world order, the whole human project. It will smash them totally, devastatingly, finally, eternally. There is only one kingdom that's going to last forever, and that is God's kingdom. When is this rock, the rock of God's kingdom, when is it going to strike the statue? When is God's kingdom going to crash into this world? Answer, it's already happened. Verse 44, in the time of those kings, the kings of Rome, the Caesars, it's in those times that the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. God's kingdom came crashing into this world when a baby was born in Bethlehem 2,000 years ago in the days of Caesar Augustus, a baby born to be king. And the rulers of this world tried to destroy him, and they couldn't. When Jesus began to preach in Galilee at the age of 30, his first message was, God's kingdom has arrived. Jesus himself had come as king, and that meant that God's kingdom had arrived. What did men try to do? They tried to silence him. They arrested him. They tried to stop the stone from rolling. They put him on trial. They questioned him. Are you the king? Pilate tried to set him free, But the priest said, if you set this man free, you're not Caesar's friend. This man Jesus is a threat to Caesar's empire. That's why they crucified him. Because he claimed to be the bringer of God's kingdom. And that was a threat to Caesar's kingdom. And when he was dead, they breathed a sigh of relief and said, Caesar's empire, the empire of man, the empire of human pride, the empire of human achievement, it's safe again. Jesus is dead. His followers are driven underground. We have no king but Caesar. And 3 days later, a group of frightened, heartbroken women went to the tomb to mourn the death of their king. And even while they were on their way to the tomb, they felt the ground on which they walked shaken by an earthquake. And when they arrived at the tomb, they were met by angels who had come down from heaven to declare, he is not here, he is risen. The great stone had struck. Jesus, whom men had crucified, was alive. He had defeated all the powers of human government, of human law, of human executioners. All the apparatus of human power was blown to bits when Jesus rose again from the dead. From that moment, the statue was toppling. The resurrection meant that the real king had begun his reign. The power of God's kingdom, the kingdom of heaven, had been set free to work here on earth. Jesus called his disciples to him and said, all authority in heaven and on earth is given to me. And since then, Jesus' disciples have been going out into all the world, proclaiming that Jesus is king, and gathering men and women and children into his kingdom. And human kings and governments have fought to prevent the kingdom of Jesus from growing. They've attacked his kingdom. They've persecuted his followers. They've ranted on about how man doesn't need the kingdom of God. But nothing they've done has prevented Jesus from winning victory after victory. Oh yeah, they're still there. The empires of men. The human ambitions are still being promoted. The human attempts to sideline God are still there. The statue is still just about standing. Rome's power is still traced throughout the world. But the statue is teetering, it's toppling. And one day soon the skies are going to open. And the king is going to appear in all his radiant glory, all his majesty. Oh, I shall see him descend from the sky. Jesus is coming. And then finally all man's rebellion against God will be crushed. And every human empire will be smashed to smithereens. And Jesus shall reign where'er the sun doth his successive journeys run. Men set themselves up as gods. Great men do that. They want to reign on a global scale. And little men do that too. They want to reign in a little sphere where there's no room for God to come in. They want to live independently of God. They want to keep up their rebellion against God and pretend to themselves that they're self-sufficient. Men everywhere set themselves up as gods and they say, we don't need him. And they're going to be smashed at the coming of Christ. All their pretenses, all their illusions, all their lies, all their rebellion. They're not going to be able to stand for one moment when he comes in his blazing glory. Men set themselves up as gods, and they're going to be smashed. But Jesus, who was by very nature God, did not consider his equality with God something to be grasped. He made himself nothing. He became obedient. Humbled himself even to death on a cross. And therefore, God highly exalted him and gave him the name that is above every name. Above the name of Nebuchadnezzar and Cyrus and Alexander and Caesar. All these men have been labeled the great. There's only one name that is going to be great. One name above every name. The name of Jesus, the incomparable. Every knee shall bow, and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. That's what the whole universe is moving towards. That's what Nebuchadnezzar, this proud king, was being forced to see in his dream. That in the end there is only going to be one kingdom, and there's only going to be one king. King Jesus. Some of us are proud to say that he is our king now. We're proud that we have a king who's worthy to be king. There came a point when we realized that we weren't fit to rule our own selves, let alone to rule the world. There came a point where we knew that we had to abdicate from the throne, and we had to enthrone Jesus. One day he is going to reign visibly before every creature. Some of us are glad to worship him now. May God speak to our hearts through his holy and infallible word.